News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Togo's Armed Forces spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Sama Suso, in a statement read Thursday night on state Togolese television, TVT, and carried live on their YouTube channel, confirmed the military accidentally killed seven teenagers.
That's reporter Matteo Frashini-Kofi on the death of seven teens in Togo when a military aircraft mistook them for Islamist militants. Details coming up. Also, a recent survey shows five countries in the Africa Sahel region are more connected to the internet today than they were before the COVID pandemic. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Togo's military says one of its aircraft accidentally targeted and killed seven teenagers in the country's north, mistaking them for Islamist militants who were initially suspected in the attack. Matteo Frashini-Kofi reports from Lomé, Togo.
Togo's Armed Forces spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Sama Suso, in a statement read Thursday night on state Togolese television, TVT, and carried live on their YouTube channel, confirmed the military accidentally killed seven teenagers.
Communiqué des forces armées togolaises. Dans la nuit du 9 au 10 juillet 2022,
he says the military expresses its profound regret in the face of the incident and says everything possible will be done to prevent this sort of tragedy from happening again. Togo's Army Chief of Staff, General Daja Maganawe, in a written statement, said an aircraft had wrongly targeted the civilians in the village of Markba in the northern Savannah region, Stone Prefecture. The statement said the army had intelligence indicating an imminent threat of infiltration by armed groups wanting to attack local communities. Local media initially blamed the early Sunday morning blast on an improvised explosive device, pointing the suspicion at Islamist militants. The victims instead were teenagers on their way home from celebrating Eid al-Adha, Islam's festival of sacrifice, known in the Wolof language as Tabaski. Michel Douty, an independent security expert working with Togo's Interministerial Committee for the Prevention and Fight Against Violent Extremism, CPLEV, praised the army for taking responsibility.
C'est un acte de courage, un acte de bravoure.
He says it was an act of courage, an act of braveness, an act of transparency, an act caused by the desire and the obligation to be accountable and show what the army is doing in the fight against violent extremism. Togo declared a state of emergency in the Savannah region in June after Islamist militants attacked near the border with Burkina Faso, killing 8 troops and wounding 13. An Al-Qaeda-affiliated group fighting in Burkina Faso and Mali claimed responsibility for the attack. They were the first recorded deaths from terrorism in Togo, a country of 8 million people on West Africa's Gulf of Guinea. Matteo Frashini-Kofi for VOA News, Lomé, Togo.
Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara and two of his predecessors say they hope yesterday's face-to-face meeting will serve as a starter for easing the national socio-political climate. Ouattara had closed-door talks with longtime rivals Laurent Gbagbo and Henry Konan Bédé for the first time since the end of the 2011 post-election crisis that killed at least 3,000 people. The current president said he'd like this type of meeting to occur regularly. Government spokesman Amadou Coulibaly said the meeting is part of the recommendations for political dialogue between the government, the political opposition, and civil society. Gbagbo served as the leader's spokesman at the end of the meeting. He read a statement calling it a reunion meeting to renew contact and exchange in truth their views. Sub-Saharan Africa remains one of the least connected places on the planet when it comes to internet access. A recent Gallup survey shows 5 countries in the Sahel region are more connected today than they were before the COVID-19 pandemic. I talked to R.J. Reinhardt, an analyst, writer, and editor for Gallup.com and for Gallup's Higher Education and Government Divisions. He started out by explaining how Gallup works.
So Gallup World Poll has basically been around since around 2005-2006, and it's a series of interviews with individuals in at least 140 countries per year, typically closer to 160. And what it basically boils down to is there are two different modes that we use to interview people. We either interview people face-to-face, where we literally have individuals on the ground that go to random addresses, you know, throughout a country and ask a battery of questions, or we call individuals randomly on landline or mobile telephones. Primarily in Africa, it's face-to-face, although there are some countries where we still have to do phone calls. During the pandemic, we switched over primarily to doing phone calls just for health reasons. But basically, it typically is what we would consider to be a nationally representative survey of each country, which means we interview at least 1,000 people by one mode or the other in every country.
The latest is that Gallup survey shows 5 countries in the region are more connected today than they were before the COVID-19 pandemic, with internet access growing substantially by 10 percentage points or more between 2019 and 2021. That's the article you wrote. So basically, based on that, how did you compile that number?
When we look at basically, we looked at the 2019 data and we compared it to the 2021 data because we had those same modes for both years for most of these countries. And when we looked at answers to a specific question is, do you have access to the internet? That can be on a mobile phone, a computer, or some other device. And so basically everyone that we interviewed was asked that question. And when we compile it, we weight our responses by the demographic factors for the country, so it is nationally representative. And so as we said, when you look at it, you look at South Africa in 2019, 52% of the population said they had access to a mobile phone, computer, or some other internet-connected device. In 2021, 66% said they had access to the internet. So that's a 14-point increase there. You also had 10-point increases in Senegal, where it went from 41 to 51%. You had a similar increase in Guinea, where it went from 23 to 33%. In Sierra Leone, there was an increase from 16% to 26%. And in Nigeria, access went from 26% to 36%.
So this increased internet access in these countries, 5 countries, are you saying it reflects an increased investment in telecommunications infrastructure from the public and private sectors?
I mean, it's hard for us to draw any sort of causal relations, again, you know, just because we ask that question and it's very difficult to dig into that. But, you know, it does correlate with additional investment by both private and public entities in that infrastructure.
That was R.J. Reinhardt, analyst, writer, and editor for Gallup. He talked to me from Gallup's offices here in Washington, D.C. Concerns have grown that the exit of 2,400 French troops from Mali, the epicenter of violence in the Sahel region and strongholds of both Al-Qaeda and Islamic State affiliates, is worsening violence, destabilizing neighbors, and spurring migration. French officials headed to Niger today to redefine the country's strategy to fight Islamist militants in the Sahel. Niger will become the hub for French troops, with some 1,000 based in the capital Niamey, with fighter jets, drones, and helicopters. Emily Estelle, manager of the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi why these strategy will not be enough as an alternative to French presence in Mali.
It's clear from the type of conflict happening in Mali that this cannot be solved from the air. So security conditions on the ground are getting worse already, and intermittent airstrikes on jihadist targets will not solve that. This would be a challenge even if coordination between the French forces in Niger and the ground forces in Mali was strong, but this is not the case. Other European forces are leaving Mali already, and relations between the Malian government and the UN mission there are deteriorating. Furthermore, the Malian military and Russian Wagner group that's now present have been accused of massacres. And so they're therefore more likely to worsen the cycle of violence in Mali than break it. And that's more than the French forces in Niger can overcome, certainly.
France would also dispatch some 300 to 400 troops for special operations with Niger troops in the border regions with Burkina Faso and Mali. Another 700 to 1,000 troops would be based in Chad, with an undisclosed number of special forces operating elsewhere in the region. French officials said the onus going forward would be on regional countries to lead the security and also focusing more on development, good governance, and education. What do you make of the combination of combating militants security-wise and good governance, development, and education?
The goal of combining the military effort with good governance is the right one, but it's far from a new goal, unfortunately, and the problem, as always, is still implementation. It's not clear to me what investments the French will really be able to make in good governance and development in the most violence-affected areas, and the regional states in question also have a lot of political, economic, and security constraints that they're going to struggle to overcome. I'll also note that the jihadist threat is changing quite quickly, particularly toward the Gulf of Guinea states. So relying on a traditional development response at this point is probably already too slow to actually stop the expansion of the jihadist threat in this area.
Coups in Mali, Chad, and Burkina Faso have weakened France's alliances in its former colonies, emboldened jihadists who control large swaths of desert, and opened the door to greater Russian influence through the mercenary groups. How did Islamist militants use political instability and military coups to expand their violent activities in the African continent?
So starting with the instability part of this, jihadist groups in the Sahel have become really quite adept at inserting themselves into local situations and exploiting them. So let's say there's an area with tensions between ethnically aligned communities over land use, and jihadists have been able to come in armed and either position themselves as a solution to the problem or, if necessary, force an agreement at the point of a gun. The more vulnerable communities just don't have the capability or the backup to resist the jihadist armed groups that are better prepared. So many of these governments in the region really aren't prepared to deal with this challenge, and the coups that we've seen have even moved them farther away from being able to address it, at least looking at Mali's case especially, where the coup has led to a more aggressive military response that will only serve to deepen the pre-existing grievances that allowed the jihadist groups in the first place. These military responses tend not to bring long-term improvements in security or governance, and even if the military can pull off a short-term crackdown on jihadist groups, they tend to do so now in a way that makes jihadists more likely to come back and strengthen over time, because the attacks on civilians on the part of some of these militaries tend to backfire.
That was Emily Estelle, manager of the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Chad's ruling military says it will convene an inclusive national dialogue on August 20 as part of the process of holding elections. The dialogue has been postponed twice. The country has been unsettled since President Idriss Deby Itno died fighting rebels in April 2021. His son, Lieutenant General Mahamat Idriss Deby Itno, then took over as the head of a junta. He dismissed the government, dissolved the parliament, and repealed the constitution, vowing to hold free and transparent elections in 18 months, a deadline that he said could be postponed if certain conditions were not met. The forum has been repeatedly postponed in the face of discord among our armed rebel groups and rejection by Chad's political opposition. You're listening to African News Tonight, live on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Members of South Africa's ruling African National Congress today marched to the party's headquarters in Johannesburg, demanding the resignation of President Cyril Ramaphosa. with the country facing multiple challenges, including daily electricity blackouts, the group says the president no longer can resolve the problems. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Down with Ramaphosa, down!
Down!
Down with Ramaphosa, down!
Down!
Down with Ramaphosa, down!
Down!
These African National Congress ANC supporters accuse President Cyril Ramaphosa of breaking the law over a police investigation following allegations that $4 million was stolen from Ramaphosa's Palapala farm. His accusers allege the case was not reported to the police and instead the culprits were tortured and paid off to buy their silence. Kalnias is a former spokesperson of the ANC Military Veterans Wing and is allied with former President Jacob Zuma. He told VOA the party needs a new president.
There are serious charges against President Ramaphosa. He has to face those charges. The nation is embarrassed by what happened at Palapala. In the whole world, we now see reports on our television screens, which reflect our country almost as a banana republic.
The protesters also want the ANC leadership to resign. Protester Meblu Hokana told VOA that rising poverty, unemployment and crime show Ramaphosa has failed to lead the country.
He must step aside. We are enough. We are tired of him.
The marchers also demanded an immediate decrease in the gasoline price, which has risen since the Russia-Ukraine war started. They want a solution to the electricity crisis, which leaves homes and businesses without electricity for hours each day. Mohau China Kumalo, one of the ANC chaplains, he told VOA they will protest until Ramaphosa resigns.
If he does not listen, these people is the same voice that dealt with apartheid. President Ramaphosa is not bigger than South Africa. He's not bigger than the voices of the ordinary citizens of South Africa. So he will listen.
This is the first ANC group to openly march against Ramaphosa. It included a number of party officials who have been suspended for corruption allegations, and many of the protesters called for former President Jacob Zuma to return to office. Zuma was ousted in 2018 after years of mounting allegations of corruption. He is awaiting trial on several charges. Opposition parties have called for Ramaphosa's removal since the allegations about the theft came out in early June. Ramaphosa rejects accusations the theft was mishandled or he acted improperly and has said he is not leaving office. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Amid strong winds and temperatures approaching 45 degrees Celsius, 113 Fahrenheit, forest fires spread quickly across northern Morocco, killing at least one person and forcing the evacuation of more than 1,000 families. The French news agency AFP quotes officials as saying the fires broke out on Wednesday and have destroyed 1,600 hectares, nearly 4,000 acres of woodland in the provinces of Larchi, Ouezzane, Taza, and Tetouan. The army deployed four Canad Air planes to waterbomb the fires. They were joined by hundreds of personnel from the Civil Protection Service and Water and Forest Department, as well as soldiers, police, and volunteers. Fires are also raging in southern Europe, from Spain and Portugal to France and Greece. The U.S. Senate has confirmed John T. Godfrey as the first U.S. ambassador to Sudan in 25 years. Godfrey will assume the role during the tumultuous and very complicated time for Sudan following the October 2021 military takeover and the on-and-off negotiations to restore a civilian democratic government. Cameron Hudson, senior associate with the African Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, tells VOA's Nabil Biagio the move is historic, but it's not clear if it will change the nature of U.S.-Sudan bilateral relations.
The first time we've had a U.S. ambassador confirmed by the Senate go to Sudan since 1997. I don't think it changes the substance of the relationship, but it gives us a tool to better engage the Sudanese. It is a new chapter in the relationship between the United States and Sudan. Whether or not it changes the substance of the relationship, I think, is yet to be determined. And that will rely, I think, largely on the Sudanese. But it's important nonetheless because it is the final stage in a process of normalization that has been going on for several years now. And this was, I think, the final element that had not yet been put in place.
You mentioned that it's an important tool to engage Sudan. How best can Ambassador Godfrey serve his mission in Sudan, and what should be his priorities, you know, at these really uncertain times?
Well, again, he has to go to Sudan and present his credentials to a military head of state, because when he arrives in Sudan, there will likely not be a civilian leader. There will not have been an election held. So he is inheriting a very troubling portfolio. And Sudan has a very steep road ahead. It has to resolve an ongoing political crisis. It has to create a transitional government and a civilian leadership. It has to prepare for democratic elections. It has to write a constitution. I mean, Sudan is on the precipice of reinventing itself in many ways. And as the American representative in Sudan during this period, Washington remains, I think, the most influential country in Sudan still. And so there's a great deal of responsibility on the United States and Ambassador Godfrey to help bring about the changes that we want to see, but most importantly, that the Sudanese people want to see in their own country. So it's a very tall task that he has.
On the influence of the U.S. On Sudan, there are mixed signals or elements here. So the U.S. cut off assistance to Sudan following the coup in October 2021. Debt relief was suspended by the IMF and the World Bank. The U.S. Sanctioned the Central Reserve Police in Sudan. But now Washington is sending an ambassador extraordinary. How do you see these U.S.-Sudan relations at these times?
I would not try to juxtapose the sanctions and the harsh penalties that we are using right now with this idea of sending an ambassador, right? Let's remember that Washington announced that it was going to send an ambassador to Sudan 2.5 years ago. So the timing of the ambassador is important because it will allow us, to better engage diplomatically on the ground. But it should not be viewed as somehow counteracting the other tools that we are using. In fact, I would say that having an ambassador there increases the effectiveness and the impact of all of the tools we are using, whether the sanctions, whether it's diplomatic persuasion, whether it is the suspension of assistance. Having an ambassador on the ground helps us to explain what U.S. policy is and helps to inform the future direction of U.S. policy.
That was Cameron Hudson, Senior Associate with the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He spoke with VOA's Nabil Biagio in Washington. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Justin Twait, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.